Now, we've had the good fortune of having Derek Mueller here with us for just about a month. And as many of you probably do know, he has an unbelievably popular YouTube channel called Veritasium. He has almost 1 million subscribers. What you might not know is that he did his physics PhD in physics education research. It has been really, really wonderful to work with him over the last few weeks and see his passion for the learning process. And I know you're going to enjoy tonight's discussion. So, without further ado, Derek Mueller.
Thanks, Greg. Thanks for that. Hello. Thanks to all of you for coming out tonight. It's my real pleasure to be able to speak to you. As Greg said, I've been here for nearly a month, and I've been really enjoying my time. The Perimeter Institute is an extraordinary place. And it's great to have you guys here tonight. I believe a lot of you are teachers, is that correct? Who's a teacher? Hands up. Look, they're very well behaved. That's excellent. And I think something that's important for me to say when I speak to groups of teachers is, it's kind of an honor to be talking to you about my experiences, because I know that each of you has an incredible wealth of experience and knowledge. And so the things I'm showing you today are the things that I've learned over my few years teaching and making videos about science. But I'd love to continue that conversation with you and learn more from you as well. So, I make a YouTube channel called Veritasium, and the topic of my talk tonight is the secret to engagement. I think if there's one thing that being a postgraduate student teaches you, it's to kind of pick a catchy title. That's the goal when you're a graduate student. And I want to share with you some lessons from video. Now, a lot of us are teachers, and I spend some of my time going out and talking to the public about science, about what they know about science. And if there's anything that will convince you of the importance of science teachers, it's an exercise like this. So I thought I'd share with you,
Water?
Yeah. What makes water?
Water.
Okay, what elements does it take to make water?
H2O.
So what does that mean?
It is water.
How long does it take for the Earth to go around the sun?
Well, a day.
What do you reckon, cuz?
Is it 24 hours?
Obviously a day, yes.
Okay, so those things were made in Australia, but I've filmed other things in other places, and you find very kind of similar occurrences. And some of it is funny. And some of it...
What's water made of?
Ooh.
Water?
Some of it is less humorous. What's happening around the world, the level of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere? Do you know?
No, I really don't know.
You know about carbon dioxide, though?
Yeah. Is it, increasing or...? Yeah.
It's increasing globally, as far as we can tell. And why would that be? Why would the amount of CO2 be going up? You can take a moment, think about it. Why is the amount of CO2 in the world going up? Do you know? But you knew that it was going up.
Yeah. I don't know.
But why would it be going up? So yeah, it's a little uncomfortable to watch that sometimes. I show you that for a couple reasons. One, as I say, to point out how important it is to be a science teacher these days. We are facing significant issues that rely on a good public awareness of science and understanding of scientific basics. And that also kind of shows a little bit of my technique, which often is about saying nothing and seeing what happens. So, just so I know who I'm talking to, I wanted to find out how much of Veritasium of my videos you've already seen. So, if I could just get a show of hands, who here has seen none of the things that I've made and put on the YouTubes? That's very exciting for me. I'm glad to see some hands up, right? Because it means today I'm reaching new people, and hopefully you'll be excited by this as well, and you will share it. Who has seen one video? Who's seen a handful? Who's seen all of them? Yes. Okay, well, that's thank you very much. Yeah, I appreciate that. So this is, if you've seen one, this might be the one that you've seen. It's about a slinky. And in fact, I have a slinky here to demonstrate what I'm doing in this video. So basically, we've just extended the slinky under its own weight. And what we do in this video is we drop it. Well, I drop the slinky. But the thing is, it's filmed in 700 frames per second. So very slow motion is what we're gonna see in a moment. But before I play the video, I want you to predict what you're going to see. Obviously, for those of you who have seen it, you know what's going to happen. But for those of you who haven't seen it, what do you expect to see as it falls? Will it fall top and bottom together, all stretched out? Or as it falls, will it collapse? Or will the bottom go up and the top come down and meet in the middle, something like that? Just turn to your neighbor and tell them what you're thinking. What do you expect to see in this video? You've seen it. Okay, so everyone knows what they're expecting to see. I think that prediction step is really important. Now let's find out. Compare your prediction with the observations. Are you ready? In 3, 2, 1. Does not move until the whole slinky has collapsed. Really makes it look like it's hovering. Now, if a standard slinky is good, then obviously a big slinky would be much better, right? Now we're talking. That's like a 7 meter long extended slinky. You can see the very same thing happen. Now, I bet now that you've seen it in slow motion, I bet you can see it in real time. You ready? 3, 2, 1. See that? So what's the deal? Well, this is not just a thing that is a property of slinkies, it's a property of all objects. And I think that's the consciousness raiser here, to think that this happens with any object, any extended object. Now we're taking another shot from below the slinky, and we saw something a little surprising, something we hadn't seen in the other shots. If you look down at the bottom of the slinky, what you'll start to notice is this bottom will start to rotate. It'll actually start to twist. It's not gonna fall, but it will twist. That's because a torsional wave, there it goes, makes it down to the bottom before the compression wave. So there's a little bit of physics of different speeds of waves in a slinky here. There's a torsional wave which travels faster than a compression wave. And it comes and slams into it. It's pretty incredible. Now, after this video, I took the data to this guy, Professor Mike Wheatland, and we ended up getting a physics paper out of it. So what started as a YouTube video, which got over 1 million views and was my first really successful YouTube video, then became a physics paper. So I think it's a pretty extraordinary way the world is going at this point. Well, so I thought that a lot of you may have seen the slinky, so I thought, well, I need to do something that you haven't seen before, but I'm gonna need a volunteer. So can I get a volunteer who's willing to come help me with something? Wow, this is a very enthusiastic bunch. Yes, sir, thank you for volunteering. Can we welcome him to the stage? What's your name, sir? This is Frank. Frank, everyone. Let me just see if I can, here you go. Okay, Frank, here's the plan. You're gonna hold one end of the slinky, like this, okay? I'm gonna hold the other end. Oi! Okay, don't grab it off me. You can just talk into it if you like. You don't have to. Okay, so here's the deal. Let's hold it kind of out here. Yeah, let's line it up with the front. Now, what our plan is basically we're going to hold it kind of like this. Yeah, that's good. As long as we're both at the same height. Does that look good? Mm-hmm. What we're going to do, his side needs to go up. Is that right? Just a tinge? Yeah? Or how are we doing? Okay. So that what we're going to do here is we're going to... I actually want to go down. Can we go down lower?
Sure.
Let's go down. How's that? Yeah? Is that good? Now what we're going to do is we're going to release it exactly simultaneously. Yeah? Yeah. But the question I want you guys to think about before we release it is, which part of the slinky is going to hit the ground first? Will it be my end, or his end, or the middle, or... What do you think? But hang on. But what's really important when we do this is that we both release at exactly the same time. Do you guys know which side is good, what part is going to hit the ground first? No? Is anyone bold enough to take a guess? Middle? I hear two ends. So we have options. We have options. Now, we need to be able to release at exactly the same time, right? Okay, so just to practice our timing, what I normally do is I count down 3, 2, 1, and then we go on beat after that, right? Okay. But to practice, what I want you to do is just stand like this, and I want you to just tap the PI sign. Yeah, well, I'll stand here with you. Okay? So I just want to make sure that we're in sync. Ready? 3, 2, 1. That was not bad, right? That was not bad. Let's do it again. 3, 2, 1. What do you think? One more time. Okay. Yeah. 3, 2, 1. I feel like it's just like, okay. Okay. Which one are you going to use to hold the slinky?
This one.
Okay. 3, 2, 1. That was perfect. That was perfect, right? So let's check it out and see if you can spot when we let it go, which part of the slinky is going to... Ooh, that's good. Look at this. This is brilliant. I'm kind of holding a full coil. Is that all right? You going to hold a full coil? Yeah, let's get close to the ground. Ready? You're watching carefully? Yeah, it's good if it's stationary. How are the heights? Has it got to go up a touch? How's that? Is that good? Are you ready? Ready? 3, 2, 1. Thank you. What did you see?
I saw it come together and then the whole thing fell at once.
Whole thing fell at once. Interesting. Okay. But thank you very much for being part of my demonstration. I wasn't sure, frankly, if we'd be able to see anything there. But I know that it's been done before in this classroom. This was done in a high school classroom, actually the classroom of Frank Noschesi. So I think he may be watching over the web stream. Thank you very much for allowing me to use this video tonight. Hopefully we'll be able to see it a little bit clearer here. Even after doing my regular slinky drop a number of times, this still surprised me. Here we go. Yeah. The middle is the last part to fall, right? The ends are starting to release that tension, but the middle is still held up by the tension. You don't think about that upward tension, which is still in the slinky. Anyway, so the slinky obviously has some fascinating physics associated with it, and even after you do some really cool demos, there's always more to do. Now, I wanted this talk to be a little bit interactive with you, as you may have gathered already. We've done some questions. I'm going to ask you another question. This is just kind of a warm-up question, but it's also something I want you to keep in the back of your mind for the rest of the talk. Is that all right? Okay, so here's the question. It's a pretty straightforward question. We have a toy bat and a ball, which together cost $1.10. Okay? The bat costs $1 more than the ball. How much does the ball cost? Who says A, 10 cents? Who says B, $1? Who says C, 90 cents? Who says D, 5 cents? I'll have the record show that the majority of people here did not answer, okay? Did you feel like it was a trap? Yeah? So if you listen to the voice in your head when you first hear the question, if you're anything like me, and I think like a lot of people, the answer A comes to mind very quickly and very easily. Would you agree? Yeah. But in fact, A is, of course, not the right answer. The right answer is D. It's 5 cents. But this is an interesting question because it's been asked to thousands of incoming students at universities, a lot in the US, because this was sort of on a psychology, standard psychology test. And typically, the rates are around 80% would get the question incorrect. roughly 80% of people would say 10 cents. It's kind of interesting because it's a basic math problem, right? If you go to elite schools like Harvard, Yale, Princeton, that sort of thing, then you'd find about a 50% error rate. So 50% would say 10. So there's a question of why don't people do better on this question? Maybe that's something you guys can think about. I mean, one thing that we could say about the respondents is that they were probably capable of answering the question, right? After saying, okay, well, the ball is 10 cents, I bet they were capable of the mathematics to say, okay, well, if the ball is 10 cents, and the bat's a dollar more than the ball, the bat is $1.10, and so together they'd be $1.20. It doesn't work. So one thing you can say about the respondents is that they didn't check. You know that they didn't check, and that they could have checked, and that they didn't check. Do you see what I'm saying? This is important, and it goes, I think, to the very nature of a lot of people and a lot of our students. They can check if they want to check, if they think they should check, but here they didn't think that they should check. They didn't think they needed to. Okay, think about that. Now, I want to tell you about my PhD. After doing a degree in engineering physics here at Queen's for 4 years, I was tired of the winter. And I moved to Sydney, Australia, to experience life on warm beaches. And that's where I did my PhD, which was a good choice. Now, the topic of my PhD was, how should you design multimedia to promote conceptual learning in physics? I wanted people to actually watch a video and gain some conceptual knowledge about that area of physics. And one of the reasons I wanted to do that was because I felt it would have direct application to multimedia design. And I see everywhere multimedia is becoming more available. I'm talking about videos and games, and I mean, you look at what's happening on YouTube right now, and there's a lot of educational content out there. So I guess this was with a bit of foresight that the world was going to become, you know, more rich media, accessible. And I also feel like doing this kind of research has implications for teaching, because it allows you the kind of direct, repeatable, transparent means of testing different instructional strategies. So you can put something in a video, and it may be, you know, an 8-minute snippet of some kind of teaching, and you can assess it in a way that I think is the kind of most controlled way that you could do it. And you can also kind of randomize things. The other thing that was important to me was to do it in real learning environments. So I perform my research with first-year physics students, and I allowed them to use the materials from home, using them online from wherever they were. So that was quite important to me as well. So this is the way a kind of simple experiment in my PhD went. First, you decide on the learning objectives, and then you operationalize them as a set of test questions. So the idea being, if they can answer these questions, I will say they've learned the content that I want them to know. Then what did we do with them? Took these students, we pre-tested them online, said you can go to this website, answer some questions. Then they were randomly assigned to a video. They were shown this video. At the end of the video, they were post-tested with exactly the same questions. So they've answered these questions, seen a video, and they answer the same questions again. So hopefully if the video has changed their mind about anything, they can change their answers to reflect what they've learned. I also asked them to rate how confident they were in their answers. How sure are you that this is correct? Because I thought maybe if different videos maybe didn't teach better or worse, maybe they would affect confidence in a way that I could see and that I could measure. And finally, I interviewed the students to see, did they really think that they learned? What did they like about the video? What did they dislike? Okay, so the learning outcomes that I first picked was actually a second-year subject. I did quantum tunneling. But scrapping that, later in the PhD, I tackled Newton's first and second laws because, of course, they're the bread and butter of introductory physics, and I could get a very large sample size, and, of course, this is the kind of thing everyone has to learn. So we created a 26-question multiple choice test. Here is an example question so you know what kind of thing we were doing. This says an elevator is being lifted up an elevator shaft at a constant speed by a steel cable, as shown in the figure below. All frictional effects are negligible. In this situation, forces on the elevator are such that A, the upward force by the cable is greater than the downward force of gravity, B, the upward force by the cable is equal to the downward force of gravity, smaller than the downward force of gravity, or greater than the sum of the downward force of gravity and the downward force due to the air, or E, none of the above, the elevator goes up because the cable is being shortened, not because there's an upward force exerted on the elevator. Okay, it's an interesting option, but there it is. So you can select your answer, and then please indicate how confident you are about your answer. How sure are you, in essence, that it's correct? So that's what every question looked like. There's another question, just to give you an idea. This was not actually presented in video format, but the question goes something like this. You've got a basketball player, and he's shooting from the free throw line. And once the ball leaves his hands, the forces on the ball are A, upwards and constant, B, upwards and decreasing, C, downwards and constant, D, downwards and decreasing, or E, tangent to the path of the ball. Those are your options for the kind of net force on the ball. So you can take a minute to think about what answer you would pick, and what answer you think your students might pick, or what a lot of people would pick. The answer is, of course, C, more or less. It was phrased in a way that was clear and allowed for, you know, gravity slightly decreasing as it goes. Anyway, the answer is C, all right? So these are the pre-test scores of all the students at the University of Sydney coming in first year physics. And first year physics is split into three streams at the University of Sydney. Fundamentals for people who have never studied physics at sort of grade 11 or 12, so they're pretty fresh. Regular, those students who have studied it at grade 11 and 12 perhaps have not scored, you know, absolutely the top. And then advanced for students who have done really well in physics and in school overall. They're in the top, say, 3% of their graduating cohort. And these are the scores on a test consisting of those 26 questions. It's kind of a little surprising in that the advanced students, you would think, maybe should do better because these questions are not particularly hard, right? They're basic conceptual questions, but they're not scoring on average above 20. The fundamental students are maybe performing how you'd expect. That's basically chance levels because this is, after all, a multiple choice test. There's 26 questions. And then the regular students, you know, well, they're kind of on the pass level on average, which is, you know, perhaps again concerning given that they've studied grade 11 and grade 12 physics and they've got to university. And then if we have a look at their confidence scores, I think it gets a little bit more troubling. Right, this was a confidence rated out of 7. So you might say that the advanced students are sort of fairly appropriately rating their ability, whereas the regular students and the fundamentals especially are kind of overestimating their confidence. Right? The questions seem pretty straightforward, and yet their answers are no better than chance. But they're kind of on the confident side of things. Could be a problem. We'll talk about it. Okay, so the fundamentals group is the group that I want to focus on for the rest of, or much of the rest of this talk. So I exposed these fundamental students to a video that I call the exposition. And in the exposition, what you do is basically state Newton's first and second laws. You show real-world examples of them. You give animations, graphs, diagrams, and you basically, like, we took lines straight out of a textbook, basically, and showed them, you know, everything that was relevant to these ideas. So I'll give you a little example of what that looked like. Now, this was, remember, many years ago before I had a lot of experience making videos, so this is early work, but I wanted you to see the real thing, right? This is the actual, this is an actual little snippet from the video, so check it out.
While a juggling ball is in the air, we'll ignore air resistance because it's so small. Only one force acts on the ball throughout its flight. This is the force of gravity, which is constant and downwards. Gravity accelerates the ball in the downwards direction. After being thrown up, a ball travels slower and slower upwards. Its velocity goes through zero, and then it speeds up in the downward direction. The whole time, the ball is accelerating downwards. Then it meets the juggler's hand.
Okay, so we had shown the juggler before, and then she basically came in. And this was after Newton's first and second laws were basically stated. So this was a sort of an elaboration on those points, on those ideas. It was an example. Okay, Now, this is what happened to the students' confidence. So this is the fundamental students, their confidence on the pretest, on their answers. And on the post-test, their confidence got higher. It's a good sign. That was a statistically significant increase, so looks good. When I was interviewing them, I took these students and asked them about what they thought about the video. They said, I thought it was simple to understand. Yeah, definitely very simple explanations, so it makes physics look really simple, which I know is not true. And it was also very clear and concise, to the point, doesn't go around in circles, really. Someone else said, I had something similar. I liked the simplicity of it, so the examples were something you come across all the time. It was really easy to understand because you had the visuals and the different colors and all that stuff. And also the girl, she was very clear. She didn't have too much inflection either way. So she was very commanding. You wanted to listen to her. Things are sounding good, right? Improved confidence. They rave about it. In fact, in the interviews, they liked it so much that I counted up the number of times they said simple, clear, concise, easy to understand, and how many times they said confused or hard to understand, and there's the tally for you, looking like wins all around. So how much did their scores improve? I guess I should mention that there were basically direct answers to 14 questions in that video. Like of the 26 questions they were shown, there were nearly direct answers to basically 14 of those questions, and the other 12 questions were very close transfer, you would say. You know, they were not too far apart. So the pretest average for the fundamentals in this randomly selected group was 5.5. And so what do you think the post-test scores would be? 15 to 20, 10 to 15, 6 to 10, or 5.5? Let's do a show of hands. Who thinks 15 to 20 on average? 15 to 20 on average. Who thinks 10 to 15? 10 to 15. Who thinks 6 to 10? Who thinks 5.5? Yeah, there was a lot of 6 to 10, and there was some 5.5. The answer is shown graphically here. Well, that's the pretest, and the post-test is that. That's the post-test. In case you're wondering, students did not answer exactly the same way on the pretest and the post-test. One thing I went in and looked for was, did they just answer exactly the same way as they did in the pretest? No, they changed some answers. Some got more right, and then some got more wrong. And so overall, we didn't get anywhere. We're kind of treading water. So I guess what's most troubling for me here is that the students felt like they were learning. They thought it was a great video. They thought it was a good experience for them. And yet, it wasn't, objectively, right? So, what went wrong? And this is a time when I throw it open to you for you to suggest things to me. What was the problem? Yes? They were so confident, they felt they didn't need to check. It was a bit like our question before, the bat and the ball, 10 cents. They didn't need to check. Are there ideas? Yep. Yeah, a real confidence in the worldview that they have, and they're not willing to change that based on what they see in a video. Yeah? They needed to be challenged. Yeah. I mean, it's interesting. A lot of these points, I think, are really good points. One of the most often, I think if I don't set up an audience and I kind of tell this story, one of the most frequent comments I get is, well, it's a passive learning environment, right? These students are sitting there watching a video. How do you learn from a video? You can't learn from a video. It's a passive activity. They're not engaged. Right? They're just gonna blah, blah, blah. I think that's an important point to consider. Okay, so for me, I feel like one of the big aspects was these alternative conceptions, sometimes called misconceptions. It's a whole semantic debate. But I think that there's a cycle here where the misconceptions in the first place cause a misperception. In other words, they don't see the same thing that you see. In a similar way, almost, if I show you the slinky drop before you know what happens in the slinky drop, you can't see it. But after you know what happens, you can't not see it. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. We have that expression, like, you see it to believe it. But of course, a lot of science teachers know you need to believe it to see it. And I think that that's an issue here. And then the misperception limits attention, like what the gentleman here said. You know, if they think they know it, they're not going to really focus, they're not going to pay attention, they're not going to check, they're not going to think about it very closely, and they're just going to get more confident because they're thinking, this is clear, it's easy to understand, and I'm getting somewhere, and they get more confident in what are essentially these misconceptions they held from the start. And I have kind of data to back that up, because in my interviews, I would ask them, what did you just see? What did they say in the video about X? And the student would say something like, well, gravity is the same on the way up as it was on the way down, except for there was the other force that was pushing the ball up. So that force is steadily decreased until it's reached its point of stoppage or whatever at the origin, and then it comes down with the constant force of gravity. This is what a student remembered, recalled, and told me right after watching the video. They did not see the same thing that I saw. They did not see what was there, objectively, right? They saw something, or they remembered seeing something that was already in their head, something that they had just basically seen confirmed. That's a problem. And then we go on to the next step, limiting attention. It wasn't that hard to pay attention to, I think, because I already knew what she was talking about, so I was listening, but I wasn't really paying utmost attention. I hadn't told them they scored 6 out of 26 at this point. Newton's first law, I knew already. I guess it was a bit of revision from 2 years ago. I think she's referring to grade 10 science. Okay, so they've got the perception from grade 10 that they got it, that they've understood it. And from then on, anyone says Newton's laws, it's a bit like, yeah, I've got it. It's a problem. So we have this cycle, and the question is, how do you break out of this cycle? I mean, I heard something here, you know, you need to shake them from that. Or show them something startling, something they didn't expect, something that contravenes their experience. Or maybe do you need to do more than that? Maybe a video can't do it, right? Maybe a video is a passive medium. That's a good question. So I think often in the educational literature, I see a statement like this. Learning is an effortful and mindful process, and students should be encouraged to construct their own knowledge and skills through active processing rather than being passive listeners. Who has seen a statement like this before? Who's seen something like that before, right? We have all seen it. It's out there in the literature. It's a dominant paradigm, I would say. My issue with it is it typically puts this phrase, passive listeners, everywhere. Like, you can't be an active listener. Or I don't often see that talked about. And I think that that's kind of a blind spot of this kind of theory. I totally agree that students need to be active. But that doesn't mean pushing buttons. That doesn't mean, you know, throwing stuff around necessarily. It doesn't necessarily mean that. They can throw stuff around and not learn anything, right? Or they can possibly, can they watch, can they listen, and can they be active, and can they learn that way? So that's really the question that was driving me in my PhD. So I tried a different approach, something that I call the dialogue, a new video that took in the same correct physics that was in the exposition. The same phrasing was used where possible. We had the same definitions, examples, graphs, diagrams, animations, everything to make it as similar as we could to the exposition. But we added some important factors. We added alternative conceptions raised by a student, an actor who's playing a student in the video, and then we resolved them through sort of social interaction through that kind of discourse. So basically what we did was we made the video in a way more complicated because we added incorrect stuff. And we didn't say, this is wrong. We just had a student saying, well, I think it's like this. Let me show you what that looks like.
Can you tell me what happens when a single ball goes around once?
Well, Luke's hand gives the ball a force that drives it upwards against gravity. But as it goes up, this force gradually dies away until at the very top it perfectly balances gravity. And then gravity wins and the ball falls down.
Right. So obviously they went on to have discussions after that and eventually come around to the right answer. But we were showing them incorrect things, animated incorrect things. So there was a real question of, I mean, is this going to confuse them? Is this going to backfire? Are you going to more deeply ingrain these misconceptions because you are actually presenting them? If you look at the interviews that I did, you remember with the exposition students, they typically thought that it was simple and clear, concise. With the dialogue students, nobody thought it was simple, clear, or concise. Everyone thought it was confusing or hard to understand. When you look at the results, those are the pretest and the post-test for the exposition. That's the pretest for the dialogue, which was not significantly differently higher than the others, but that's the way the random selection worked in our computer system. Here's their score on the post-test. Okay, so it's not 26 out of 26, but it's basically a doubling, nearly a doubling of their score after watching about a 10-minute video about Newton's first and second laws. I don't think that these students immediately became Newtonian thinkers. Obviously, there was still a long way to go. But if you had to compare the effectiveness of those two videos, you would say that the dialogue did a much better job. Right? It was alerting students to alternative conceptions. Well, in fact, you could ask the question, did they really change what they were thinking? I mean, what do we see in interviews? Well, I had someone say, well, I liked that the guy was just as confused as I was to begin with. The fact that he was confused kind of helped the whole explanation process in me. Oh, this was a girl. And she pointed to her head, helped her to understand. Another guy said, saying all the common misconceptions, that was really helpful. So you know what it is, but you also know what it's not. So you can know that if you end up with that, you're like, no, it can't be that. So that helped a lot. I said, did you have anything like that? And the student said to me, yeah, the juggling ball one. The misconception is there's a force and that it's slowly decreasing until it reaches the top and then it disappears or whatever. That was the misconception, I think. Now, this guy I saw from a test he did afterwards, he still answered that question wrong. But he was getting somewhere, as I think the interview shows. He kind of knew what it was, and he knew what it wasn't. Well, he certainly knew what it wasn't. So he had a point of reference to work with. He had an anchor. Often I give this talk, and a teacher will say, okay, so what we need to do is blow up these misconceptions. We need to just blast them out. And I would say, you know, the misconceptions are, in a way, your best foothold. Because you know that in all of these situations, or a lot of these situations, that's the idea that will be triggered by the student. That's the idea that has the strongest association in their head, right? When a ball is thrown in the air, the idea that there's an upward force as the ball is going up is a very powerful, strong idea, and it will stay with them. So if you find some way to tether your teaching to that idea, to associate it with that concept, I think you have a much better chance of your teaching surviving longer because it's tied to that. You don't kind of want to create something that competes because it's never going to win. You want to create something that builds on the alternative conception, helps them contextualize why it seems that way and why it, in fact, is not that way. So that would be my suggestion. And so, you know, a really important question for me was, did these videos change? I mean, did the dialogue change the way the students viewed the video? So right after the video played, I asked these students, how much mental effort did you expend while you watched the video? Oh, there's a little quote about mental effort. So this student is saying, I liked that it was asking me questions, so I actually had to think about it rather than just telling me stuff, because then it had more relevance to me. Also, by then asking those questions, I didn't feel as stupid as I did beforehand. Okay, so again, there's kind of an affective, an emotional benefit as well. Okay, so this is the graph that I was talking about. We asked students on a 9-point scale, I believe, how much mental effort did you invest in watching that video? The exposition students rated around a 5, which was neither low nor high mental effort, whereas the dialogue students rated around a 6. So we had a statistically significant difference in the self-reported mental effort after watching this video. The dialogue changed the way the students watched the video. They watched it more engaged than the students who saw an exposition. And to me, that's one of the really exciting things, and something that I aim for in my own videos, is to change the way people are watching by changing what you're presenting. And that, in effect, it does seem to work, as evidenced by this, and as evidenced by the gain. Okay, so this is a new way to look at the data that we've looked at before. I thought you guys might be interested in seeing how the higher level groups did, the regular students and the advanced students who also had the same treatments. So what the graph shows here is gain. So that's number of questions more correct on the post-test minus the pre-test, basically. Right? So we see with the exposition, the fundamental students scored, you know, barely, well, it was about 0.3 more correct, whereas the dialogue students scored nearly 5 more correct on the post-test compared to the pre-test. Okay, but if you have a look at the regular students, they did slightly better with the exposition. They still did the best with the dialogue. I think there is a trend here towards the more knowledge you have and the less these misconceptions are part of your sort of thinking, the more effective an exposition is. So if we go up to the advanced group, there actually isn't a significant difference between their exposition and dialogue results. And the dialogue still looks to be very effective and perhaps more effective, but you know, within the uncertainties of my experiment, they both kind of boost scores a similar amount. The point being, the more advanced your students are, the more they know already, the less important it is to address these alternative conceptions, which of course makes sense. So that's why if people ask me about something like Khan Academy and they say, you know, is that really effective? Is that really working for anyone? I say, well, the chances are it's working least well for novices. It's working probably the best for people who kind of required a refresher, who knew it at one point and just wanted a brief sort of summary again to brush up. So I think that there is definitely a value in direct expository explanations and things. It just is not for novices. It doesn't seem to pay off for novices, especially in these conceptually difficult areas. So I wanted to show you how we might apply this, the idea of showing alternative conceptions in a video. Something that I thought, well, maybe no one is ever going to bother doing this because it's kind of hard and it seems weird and it takes longer. But that's kind of where Veritasium started. So I'd like to show this, share this with you. Oh, hang on. We have that card with a little round hole in it. And what I want you to do is hold it up and try to cast a shadow on that wall there. Okay. And I want you, before you do it, to predict what we're going to see.
Shadow of the card.
Shadow of the card.
With a little hole in it.
We'll see that figure enlarged on the wall.
It's not very pronounced, but you can actually do see the little hole in it. And of course, me.
So cool. Little circular hole.
Woohoo!
My next question for you is, we have this card. What's that like?
It's a bigger hole.
Can you tell me what size circle we're going to see? Compared to the other one?
Bigger. Like twice the size, maybe?
But still, the card with the larger round hole.
What do you see?
Bigger hole.
The card and the hole slightly bigger than the previous one.
And the same thing, just larger.
Okay, what I want you to do...
It's approximately the same size, though. It's approximately the same size as the last one.
Why don't we compare it? Here you go.
You're right, it is. One's just fainter than the other.
Oh, goodness. It actually looks about the same.
Same size hole.
I can't believe that. It must be the sun playing tricks with my mind.
What about... Here's really going to test you, right?
Okay.
Tell me about what's on that card.
It's a triangle.
Yeah.
Okay.
So what do you expect that we'll see on the wall?
A triangle, but I wouldn't be surprised if it was a circle.
What are we going to see?
A triangle. I'm certain.
Okay, let's have a look.
Oh, wow. That's awkward for me. It's a circle.
It'll be a triangle.
Well, we're not going to see a triangle.
Why not?
Because everything else has been a circle, so it'll be a circle.
I'm sticking to triangle. Okay, it's a circle.
Let's have a look. I'm interested. Well, there you go. It's a circle.
Do you want to compare it to the one of the others? I'll give you
the bigger one. Oh my goodness, I really like this project. I'm learning something. The sun is definitely playing tricks in my mind.
The sun is deceptive.
That's weird.
Why are we seeing circles with all these cards, regardless of the shape of the hole?
really don't know. I'd like to know.
When you take away the definition from any kind of shape, it ends up being just round to our eyes.
There, for example, you get a perfect triangle.
But it was a pretty decent circle from back.
So you must get to a certain size here. It doesn't matter what shape it is. It's just turned back probably.
Why is it going to a circle though?
When you look at the sun, it looks sort of round, doesn't it? So I'm not sure if that's got anything to do with it.
Well, the light is going through these little holes, and it is the sun. The sun rays just sort of going through those little holes, making a circle of the sun. I don't know. You tell me.
Exactly. You nailed it. What we're looking at there is actually an image of the sun.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
The Earth's round and the sun's round.
Yeah,
and
the sun's round, I guess.
The building's round.
The building's round, is it? No, the building's not round.
So what we're seeing is
a projection of the sun.
I've never thought about it before.
I think that you actually know, and I think you have actually thought about it before, but I think you're not cueing that right part of your brain that knows the answer.
Yeah, probably.
There's a part of your brain that knows the answer.
Well, I did photography at school, and we did pinhole cameras. The hole actually reflects what it's showing on the wall.
So? What?
So you see what you see on the other side.
So what's that?
So it's the sun.
Well, there you go. I learned something today, Derek.
Warms my heart. Okay, time for you guys to answer another question. I have a little demonstration for you that I like to call the spool. That's the spool. Here's the way the spool works. It's a two-part experiment. In the first part, I have a spool with some of this rope wrapped around it. You guys can all see that, yeah? And the rope is currently coming over the top. You see that? You know what I mean? It's coming over the top. I'm seeing a lot of blank faces. You know what I'm talking about? Now what I'm going to do is place it on the table like so, and I'm going to pull this rope horizontally towards me. Like this. Yeah? And the question is a simple one. Which way is the spool going to go? It can go to the right, to the left, or it depends. If your answer is C, it depends, then you need to be able to tell me what it depends on. Okay, you're not allowed to pick that one because you don't want to pick the others, okay? So, again, I make the point that this is a two-part experiment. This is part one. Don't overthink it. Okay? Just take a moment, turn to the person next to you, tell them what's going to happen. Okay, let's get a show of hands. Who is saying it will go to the right? Who says it'll go to the right? A lot of hands, this is good to see. Who says it go to the left? No dissenters? Was that like a half a hand? It's okay, you can be, you know, half in that camp. Who says it depends? One here, anyone else? One up the back? Can I hear what it depends on? You don't think it's coming over the top? You think I'm messing with you? Yeah. What? Do you want to come up here? Do you want to come have a look? Oh, come on. I think it's very, very bold of you to come up here. What's your name, sorry?
Michelle.
You're a teacher?
Yes.
I'm Derek.
I don't teach physics either.
Okay, what do you teach?
Help? Biology.
Biology. Well, this is, we have a different problem here than biology physics. We've got a problem of doubt, right?
Yep.
So I just wanted you to come over and have a look and just verify that the rope is, in fact, coming over the top. Is it coming over the top?
The part that I can see.
The part that you can see. Wait, what have I done? You know what I mean? What have I done, Michelle, to lose your trust so far this talk, right? All I've done is being, you know, forthright with you. Here's what I would like you to do. I would like you to pull the rope. Okay, but hang on. Let's talk about strategy here. Okay, we want to pull horizontally like this. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
It's pretty easy. Mm-hmm. And just slowly, because you don't want to hurt anyone. Mm-hmm. Okay. So yeah, everyone knows what you're going to see. Ready, three. Oh, and it's ready. It's already going. But anyway, you go ahead. Go ahead. Just give it a bit more. So everyone's clear. It's going to the right. Okay. It's very good.
Okay.
Now, let's not applaud that too soon. Let's get to part two of the experiment. Part two of the experiment involves the rope coming underneath the bottom. Okay, so now we're there. We're where you want it to be, right? To start with. And you trust me now, I hope,
okay.
It is coming out of the bottom. Yeah, you trust me?
Yes, it's coming out of the bottom.
Okay, it's coming out of the bottom. Everyone can see that. So, I don't want you to pull this yet. Can you let go? Okay, good. I don't want to give it away too soon. So let's, perfect. Okay. Now, we're going to do the exact same thing, and Michelle is going to pull this device for us, but let it go. Just the rope. No. Put that down. You can have that. Okay. This one we're letting go of. Okay. You're doing excellent, Michelle. You're doing excellent. Thank you so much. Okay, so here's what we're doing. We're doing the spool, and now we've got the rope coming underneath the bottom, and the question is, will it go to the right, to the left, or it depends? I want you guys to turn to your neighbor and tell them what's going to happen. Go ahead, do it now.
Wasn't what I thought it was the first time. The way the rope's tucked underneath. It reminds me of a black box experiment.
It's just meant to be like.
Yeah.
I don't want to mess with anyone. You know.
That's okay. Just, no. Because it tucked underneath, and I went, wait a minute, that rope.
He's trying to do something.
He's trying to do something.
Yeah. Yeah. But you trust me now.
Okay.
Do you?
Maybe.
Oh God. It's a hard one to win over. Okay. Can I get your opinions? Who thinks that this will go to the right? No, hang on. To the right. You're right. Who thinks it'll go to the right? Only to the right, and always to the right. Who thinks it will go? Yes, hands if you think that. Yes. Who thinks it will go to the left? Always to the left and only to the left. Who believes that it depends? Yes, gentlemen here. How fast I jerk the rope. So it's not going to be me. I may help Michelle, but okay. So if Michelle does it slowly, which way? To your left. And if she does it fast, then what? Why is that? What do you think, Michelle?
It's going to go that way.
Going to go that way. If you pull it slow?
Mm-hmm.
Why don't we try it? I'll hold the mic for you. Ready? 3, 2, 1.
Is that slow enough?
Pull it.
You want me to pull it harder?
No, but I mean, did you see what you expected?
No.
So why did that happen?
I don't know how much I was pulling on it. So you're just winding it up.
You're winding it up, rather than unwinding it.
Right.
Isn't that kind of weird? It was the majority of people here who thought it was going to go the other way, right? And yet it doesn't. I bet there's some physics teachers here. Are there physics teachers here? And you guys guess wrong? I've seen this done in rooms full of physics PhDs with physics professors, and it happens every time. That's why I love the spool. So simple, so clear, and yet it gets them every time. In fact, this got me twice. You can grab that. This experiment, this demo, I was fooled twice. And the second time, I remember thinking, I've seen this before. And I know it's not what you would, but I still think. And I said, like the gentleman here, I said, it depends. You pull it fast, of course you can get it towards you. But if you pull it slowly, it'll unwind and roll the other way. Why do we think that? Well, I don't know about you, but I have had that experience where you're like, you're reaching for the toilet paper and you pull on it and it rolls away from you. And you're like, why? You know what I mean? That experience sticks with you. It gives you this sort of intuitive sense, so you have this immediate answer, you know, in a similar way to the bat and ball question, you know? 10 cents. I know it. I feel it. I don't need to check. Right? That's the problem. You do need to check. Thank you, Michelle. Can everyone thank Michelle for coming on here? Thank you so much.
Now my department head is happy I don't teach physics.
But this is what I'm saying. Everyone gets it wrong, and that's why I love doing it, because it's so much fun. Right? That's a fun little toy for you guys to try out. I've actually done that at, I don't know if this is, I won't say the name of the institution, but it's a place that produces a lot of higher education textbooks. And I was giving a talk to them, and I got basically the whole room of 18 editors, minus one, who got it right? Okay, so let's try something else. How about, when during the day are you the lightest? Michelle, you're a biologist, I think. This is a question more up your alley, but I'm willing to take any suggestions here. When during the day do you weigh the least? First thing when you wake up, just before lunch, just before dinner, right before bed, or at some other time? Can I get a suggestion down here? What do you think? Sorry? I don't want to be wrong. It's okay, we can all be wrong in here together, right? Just before dinner. It's an interesting time to be heaviest, but okay. Other ideas? First thing when you wake up, that is when you are lightest, right? Lightest. You were saying lightest. I get it. Other suggestions? Let's do a show of hands. Who thinks first thing when you wake up? Who thinks just before lunch? Who thinks just before dinner? Sorry. And right before bed? Or other? Okay, I'm not going to ask you what that is. Okay, what I saw here was fairly similar to what I saw for a video that I made. This whole video came about because my housemate came to me one day in Sydney and said, "Hey Derek, you know how you're heaviest at night right before you go to bed and you're lightest in the morning when you wake up?" Like she was basically just stating fact to me. Like, "Derek, heaviest at night, lightest in the morning." And I was like, "Does that make any sense?" She was like, "Sure." Anyway, I found that this was a common opinion. And then the question is, why is it a common opinion? And is it correct? These are good questions. Okay. So I Googled it after my friend, we had this discussion. Hang on.
And the results were a little bit disturbing.
I'll be 3 to 5 pounds heavier during the nighttime hours, and when I wake up the next morning, I'm back down 5 pounds less. I usually weigh myself in the morning. I'm anywhere from 3 to 5 pounds lighter. Odd. An empty body weighs less than a full one. The force of gravity also can weigh a person down. Really? Internet? This is what we're coming to? But these are just people posting on forums. Maybe people out on the street are different, so I'm gonna go find some people in Perth and see what they say.
But what time of day do you weigh the most?
Oh.
What do you reckon?
I suppose evening time when you've eaten too much.
Yes. Night time?
Yeah, night time.
Night time.
Night time. Just before you go to bed.
Yeah, I'd say that as well.
And you're lightest in the morning when you wake up?
Well, you're lightest when you first get out of bed, so obviously if you keep on eating and drinking during the day...
And you know, I can prove it because I'm one of these sort of people that weigh myself every single morning of my life, and I'm always lightest in the morning.
When are you the lightest?
First thing when you wake up.
Just right when you wake up?
Yeah.
You hop out of bed?
Yeah.
You are a light man?
Yeah.
I think it's interesting how widespread this idea is. You're heaviest at night, lightest in the morning. Is it true? How do you find out? You do the experiment. So I was in Perth at the time. I was trying to work this out, staying at a hotel. I asked them to borrow a scale so that I could do the experiment. They said, "Derek, you can borrow a scale, but it's our baggage scale. We can't let you take it to your room, but you can come down to the front desk whenever you want to use it," right? So, you know, and for science, you need repeatability. So I didn't just do this once. I did this every night for a week. They would see me come down at like midnight in my PJs, and the next morning, like before I went to the bathroom, I would come down. So I had to, right? I was doing this scientifically to get perfect, accurate data. I did this for science, and it took over my life. Now, the question for you is, how much weight do you think I lost every night? It was a fairly consistent amount, I will tell you. It didn't vary really that much. So how much weight do you think I lost every night? Who thinks that I lost less than 100 grams? Less than 100 grams every night. Who thinks I lost 250 grams or so, half a pound? Who thinks I lost 500 grams, about a pound? Who thinks I lost a kilogram, roughly, 2.2 pounds? Who thinks I lost more than that? More than that being lost overnight. Question?
No. You weighed yourself in the morning before going to the office?
Correct. Oh, sorry. Yeah, but it's important to establish these facts. The only variable that changed was, I mean, the only thing that happened to me was sleep. I made sure that that was it, right? No eating, no drinking, no snacking, no bathroom. Okay. So, the answer is B, 250 grams. On average, I lost half a pound every night. And so then my question to you is, where did that mass go? Sweat, water breathed out. And the contention that I will make to you is that about 150 grams of the 250 grams goes as water. This is water lost through your skin and also breathed out in your exhalations. So the question is, where does that 100 grams, where's that other 100 grams going? What do you mean? Okay, so what's happening? Uh-huh. Makes a tree. The guy has got it. He's nailed it. Yeah? Some of it went to generate heat. And in fact, you can do the calculation like an E equals MC squared calculation. You're like a 100-watt light bulb. That's roughly your energy. You give off 100 joules a second. And so if you do that for a whole night, it works out to be in the millions of joules. But if you use E equals MC squared, the amount of mass that works out to be is about 32 nanograms. So the amount of energy is a significant amount of energy, but as soon as you convert it to a mass amount, it doesn't turn out to be that much. So the amount of mass, the real place where you're losing 100 grams is by breathing out the carbon in the carbon dioxide. You'll lose about 100 grams of carbon as you sleep. And the question I typically get asked is, well, Derek, then we lose this mass all the time, right? Like during the day too. And the answer is yes. Every roughly 8 hours of being alive, you are losing roughly 100 grams of carbon if you're, you know, anything like my size. So, and the way it goes is like this. Every time you breathe, that's 500 milliliters of air going in, of which 105 mil is oxygen. Now you breathe out 82.5 milliliters of that oxygen without doing anything with it. But 23.5 milliliters, which is the difference there, is replaced by carbon dioxide, which is, of course, different from oxygen by only that carbon atom. So the mass of carbon atoms in every exhalation is about a hundredth of a gram. But if you add that up, 16 breaths a minute by 60 minutes by 8 hours comes out to be nearly 100 grams. Losing 100 grams worth of carbon atoms as you sleep. When I get to this point, and in the video when I get to this point, people are like, so Derek, I was right, you are lightest in the morning. No, that is not the point. The point is, you lose 250 grams overnight. That's the mass of a cup of water, okay? If you wake up in the morning, you drink a cup of water, you're back at the same mass you were last night when you went to bed. The point is, the mass difference between night and morning is very small. There is a mass difference, and it is for good reasons, but it's not that much. This is the point I make. You know, I talked to some biology students, and they're in this video, and they were basically telling me that that mass was being converted to energy in significant quantities. And other people saying to me, Derek, not everything that goes into you comes out of you. Like mass goes into you and is somehow, like there's a nuclear reactor inside you. That's the kind of results I received from doing this. So that's the kind of thing that always concerns me, and that's the kind of thing I am trying to spread the word about. So I wanted to bring this back to the bat and ball problem, because there was an interesting follow-up study to the bat and ball which found that when the problem was presented clearly in nice typeface on a nice white sheet of paper, that's when you got these 80% error rates. You got high error rates when the questions were clear. And if you made the presentation of these questions much worse, in a poor font, poorly photocopied, on a scrumpled piece of paper, just make it difficult to really see what's going on there, the error rates plummeted from 85% down to about 35%. By making the question harder to read, the question was answered correctly more often. I think that's kind of remarkable. In a way, it's increasing that engagement factor. It's increasing the amount of learning that could happen there, in a way. which is very similar to what we did with the dialogue in a way. We were accessing their prior knowledge, but we were doing it in such a way that they had to think harder, and they reported thinking harder. So then the question for you about, well, how do I affect my teaching so that the kids are thinking harder and thinking when they need to? One possible suggestion could be obfuscation. Make it hard for them to understand what you're saying. I don't think it's a good idea, right? So it's kind of like we're stuck in this paradox where, you could withhold information from them. So they have to engage with what you're saying. Because if they don't have to put in something themselves, they don't have to say, like, I don't have this information, or I can't read this, you know, then they're not engaging with it enough to spot that they need to change what they're thinking. So what do we do? Well, one thing you can do is not tell them. I thought I would try another little demo here with you, which is one of my favorites. It's called the spinning tube trick. Let me see if we can get the spinning tube trick to work. It will be amazing. I have here a plastic tube. It's a piece of PVC electrical conduit. And on one end, I've labeled an X, and on the other end is labeled an O. And see that? See that quite clearly there? Is that all right? Can you see that? Michelle, do you believe me? Yeah? I just want to be sure. It's a hollow tube, right? Okay. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to press on one side of it, like, say, this side, and I'm going to give it a spin by basically squirting the tube out from underneath my finger. Now, I should be, in theory, a pro at doing this, because I've done it a lot of times. What's going to happen is, after it squirts out from under my finger, it's going to spin around here, okay? What I want you guys to do is observe it and tell me what you see while it is spinning, okay? So X and O, I will first press on the X, and you guys can observe it while it is spinning. Let's try it. In 3, 2, 1. What did you see? You saw the X's. I bet you did not see the O's. This is not a trick that requires a camera, just so you know. So if you want to come up here afterwards and play with it, you can see that, you know, you can do this with your own eyes. Let's do it again. 3, 2, 1. It's a pretty simple trick to make, pretty cheap, pretty easy. So we're only seeing the X. Well, what happens if I spin the O instead? What do you think we're going to see? X, O. So you guys are playing tic-tac-toe out there. Okay, so let's give it a shot and see what happens. In 3, 2, 1. Oh, yeah? You saw the O that time. The question is, why did that happen? I'm not going to give you the answer. It's the whole point. Now you will think about it, yeah? In a way, it feels good as a teacher not to tell the answer. Doesn't it? It does. It feels good sometimes not to tell the answer. But I think you need to carefully consider the motives there. If you're not telling the answer because you want to teach your students problem-solving skills, I don't know if it works. I know that the students may just, you know, go home and make one of these and really engage in it, and it may be a great learning experience. On the other hand, there's a question over whether you can really teach a general problem-solving skill. And maybe the best thing you can do for them is build up a wealth of knowledge in a range of areas that will allow them to solve problems further down the track. But if you're withholding information so that they engage with what you're doing in the moment and then proceed from there, I think it's kind of a good approach. So I think that we should consider carefully our motivations. And during the question period, I'd be happy to discuss this further. So I want to show you one last thing, which is a video that I'm pretty proud of, where I feel like this method works well. So let's give this a shot.
What is light?
What is light? What is light? That's a good question, isn't it? What is light?
Isn't it an element?
Light is brightness, I guess.
We have auras.
We all have auras.
Which are light?
Yes, they are.
It lights up the room. It makes it not dark.
What's the difference between blue light and red light?
The color.
It goes in your eyes and then you see stuff.
They range from white to red to orange to green. It's like the chakras of your body.
Can you see my aura?
No, not particularly right now.
Is it too bright out?
It's very sunny out here today.
Does that make it harder to see someone's aura?
Not necessarily.
If I was to explain it to a blind person, right?
Yeah.
It would be the difference. You see nothing whatsoever as a blind person, whereas I see things in front of me.
To be fair, the question of what light is not an easy one. For centuries, the greatest minds in science debated this issue. In the late 1600s, Newton proposed that light was a stream of particles, or corpuscles. He proposed this in his treatise Optics. But at the same time, a Dutch physicist named Huygens proposed that light was a wave. And this debate raged on until it was settled by the experiment I've recreated today, Thomas Young's double slit experiment. To make sure I got the experiment right, I went to the original source. With the help of Brady Heron, I managed to get into the vault underneath the Royal Society in London.
Where is?
There I found Thomas Young's handwritten notes from 1803.
I brought into the sunbeam a slip of a card, about 1/30th of an inch
in breadth,
and observed its shadow, either on the wall or on other cards held at different distances. Besides the fringes of colors on each side of the shadow itself was divided by similar parallel fringes
of smaller dimensions. Wow.
This is an experiment so simple that you could make it at home, and yet so fiddly that I have never seen it before done with sunlight.
I was thinking about doing it in a box, like a fridge box.
And you could take it out on the street.
Taking it out on the street.
Could I possibly interview you guys for about a minute? We're doing a science experiment.
What I have here is an empty box.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a little eyepiece where we can look in, and this is a hole. And I'm gonna place this slide above that hole. And if you look closely, you'll see that there's two openings, very narrow openings side by side. It's a double slit. Now before we have a look, we need to tilt it towards the sun a little bit. So we want the sun to hit this double slit directly. What are we gonna see on the bottom of the box?
The obvious thing you're gonna see is two lines.
Two lines on the bottom of the box.
Two bright bands.
Two little lines.
I
think it'll be one line instead of two.
I can expect to see the whole box lit up.
It'll probably be a kaleidoscope of some sort.
A bunch of colors.
Probably, yeah.
Rainbow, different colors.
There, have a look.
You expected to see kind of one line. Is that what you see?
No.
I see dots.
How many?
It's one circle.
Well, there's one in the middle strongest, two either side.
The two on the outside are multicolored, and the one in the middle is just white.
It's kind of a rainbow?
The rainbow of color as well.
Quite a few colors and lots of little dots.
Like there are more dots appearing.
I think I can even see more dots spreading along. Yeah, that's amazing. Yeah, I can see tons of dots now. Not tons, but I can see dots spreading across that way.
Either side.
Yeah, definitely.
Isn't that amazing?
Yeah, that's incredible. And that's just nothing else apart from...
Two slits.
That's incredible.
But all we're doing is we're putting a light through two very narrow slits side by side. So how does this make any sense?
There's some kind of principle involved there that the average person is not familiar with. That's the only explanation.
No, I'm really confused by it, but I'd like to find out why.
People were debating, is light a wave or is it made of particles?
So what causes that?
Well, if light were behaving as particles, you would expect them to go through each slit and just produce a bright spot underneath. So we would see two bright spots on the bottom of the box. But if light's behaving as waves, then the wave from one slit can interact with the waves from the other slit. I've got a demonstration here on a little pond where we can see this with water waves. I have two sources of ripples, which are basically like the two slits. When I create ripples with a single source, they travel out with circular wavefronts. Nothing particularly surprising there. But if I add a second source of ripples, then we start getting an interesting pattern.
This pattern is created by the ripples from the two sources interacting with each other. Where they meet up peaks with peaks and troughs with troughs, the amplitude of the wave is increased. That's what we call constructive interference. But if the peak from one wave meets up with the trough from the other, then we get destructive interference and there's basically no wave there. And this is exactly what was happening with the light. When the light from one slit met up peaks with peaks and troughs with troughs, they constructively interfered and produced a bright spot. But if the trough from the wave from one slit met up with the peak of the wave from the other slit, they would destructively interfere and you wouldn't see any light there. It's light canceling itself out.
This is basically the same as like having two drops of water fall in a swimming pool.
That's right.
Get exactly the same
pattern.
And then
they go and overlap.
As this ripple overlaps with those ripples,
yeah,
down the bottom, you get a series of, you get like a bright spot, and then a dark spot, and then a bright spot, then a dark spot, then a bright spot.
Now there's a slight complication, which is that sunlight is composed of many different colors, and they have different wavelengths. So obviously they're gonna meet up at slightly different points. And that's what caused the rainbowing effects as we go further from the central maximum. So you saw the ones to the right were slightly colored.
Yeah,
that's because the reds are gonna meet up at different places than the blues.
And that's all that makes the color differences, is different wavelengths.
Exactly.
That's amazing.
So the difference between red and blue.
So that red bin over there and the green, the green part, is just I'm seeing
it's
that, and it's just
different
wavelength.
Length.
And that's how we bring in all these beautiful colors all around us.
Exactly.
That's amazing. I'm amazed. Oh, good on you. Thanks, Ben.
Hey, thank you.
I have been enlightened, literally.
So, I hope you check out my YouTube channel, Veritasium. It's youtube.com/Veritasium. Thank you all for coming out tonight, for listening to me speak, and thanks to the Perimeter Institute for hosting me. Thank you very much.
That was terrific. Really well done.
Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, Derek is here to answer questions. It can be about the education space that he's so passionate about. You can ask him about making the videos that he makes. You can see the quality improvement over time. That was nice. There's lots to ask. We're gonna put a microphone here. We're gonna bring the house lights up so you can see, and just make your way to the microphone and ask some questions. And I'll start. Can you tell me what it was like to actually touch the paper that Newton had written on?
Yeah, the paper that Thomas Young wrote on. I mean, it was, I was amazed, in fact, that they would let you do that. You can just kind of wander in there. You've got a YouTube channel and, you know, without gloves, you can touch this guy's 1803 manuscript. It was extraordinary. And to be able to read the experiments as he initially recorded them, it was kind of like they used this beautiful prose. And, you know, I thought it was great. Sort of connects you with the history of science, which I think is really important. And that's somewhere I'd like to go and do more on, is more historical experiments.
I had a question emailed to me, which from a teacher who said, and there, it wasn't snarky, and I could feel the passion behind it though. It was, why is a video the latest greatest thing when a lecture has become a curse word in a classroom?
Yeah.
What do you think about that?
That is a great question, and I feel like lectures in a way are unfairly maligned. I say unfairly because I think that there are things that can be done constructively in lectures. I feel like due to that sort of the viewpoint that's become dominant in the last 30 years, this idea of students being active constructors, there's been a lot of focus on getting students doing hands-on things. There's also been a focus on getting students to think for themselves. None of this stuff, I think, is bad, but I do feel like it's shifted a balance in such a way that sometimes we don't realize how much, you know, telling at the right time or telling in the right way can be effective. So I guess I put that out there. I say, you know, videos are not that great, and the lecture is not that bad. Here I am making videos. I'm trying to make them the best I can. But I think there's a variety of strategies that we can use, and everything is a tool at your disposal. So as teachers, you know, I know it's great as a teacher to be able to break up the lesson with demonstrations, with videos, with problem sets, with examples, with lecture time. I mean, I think all things contribute to a really good learning environment.
I'm going to keep asking. So the question I have tied to that is, do you want to continue doing that research? You're now consumed with making really good videos, but are you drawn to do more?
I would love to be able to do research in addition to making the videos. So I'd love to be able to test these ideas out and to test other videos out and actually see whether they're making a difference to students. You know, I get anecdotal evidence from teachers and students that they really enjoy them and that they are making a difference, but I want to know, you know, the hard data, because I think at the end of the day, that's what you have to go on.
David, question. Derek, I read a lot about the flipped classroom, I've heard about, and certainly Khan Academy has been one of those vehicles that have been proposed, you know, go home, learn, come back to the class. I guess you say it's just another tool that's out there, but your thoughts on sending kids out to learn like that. From what I saw there, if there's no foundation, it's not going to be effective. At least that's what I saw in the research you were telling me.
Yeah, and that's my sense, is that for novices, you have to be very careful about what they're looking at outside a classroom that they're meant to be learning from. And if you think, for example, that sending them home to have their first experience, let's say, with Newton's laws or you know, quantum mechanics or really anything, mm-hmm. if you want their first experience with that to be some video, like I don't think you can expect it to be that effective, generally. I think it can be part of a milieu, and it can work more effectively for really top, like bright kids or kids who are really advanced and have a decent background. But I am concerned that, you know, for novices, it's not the best thing. And I guess the biggest problem is if you think then that obviates your need to do the teaching in the classroom. Yeah, if you view the classroom only as a, you know, a time
and
to work.
And my second question is, I can't thank you enough. Every day or every other day starts off with, I can always find something relevant. I'm doing buckyballs, and my goodness, there you are proposing to someone over a candle. I can find some relevance in just about anything you've put out there. So thanks very much.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you.
You know what? Let's end on that. Thank you very much,
Derek.
It's
my pleasure. Thanks, Greg. Thank
you. Ladies and gentlemen, Derek will be here if you want to talk to him in person or try the spinning tube. But thank you very much for attending Perimeter's Teacher Talk with Derek from Veritasium. And have a great evening. Good night.